There are a number of things that are coming together in my head or my heart these days. So I'm not sure how they're all going to come together in terms of a talk. But let me start. I'd like to start this way by telling a story that we told often enough about when I was 14. I lived for a short period, for a few months, in a boarding school in Switzerland. And I was very much involved in choosing the boarding school. I knew I had to go. And we had all these brochures. And so I looked around all the brochures. And so a lot of them were unisex. So I chose the one of the few ones that was co-ed. Once I got there, you wouldn't have known. Because we were kept apart, like, with guard dogs. And then also it was partly because it was a spectacularly beautiful place. The photographs were, you know, this place on the mountainside of the Alps, overlooking this beautiful valley and mountains, snow-topped mountains on the other side, and right below a ski resort, and very pastoral, and it just seemed really idyllic. And it was. And so I was there for these about 3 months, and I found out once I got there that this school was also the place that if you had been a delinquent or rejected by other boarding schools in Switzerland, that's where you went. So it was kind of an unusual place. But anyway, I was 14, and I was walking down the road, one of the country roads, one day, a beautiful spring day with wildflowers and the blue sky and the mountains, and with an older friend from school who was 17. And just kind of spontaneously, I was in awe of the location I was in, and kind of the magnitude of nature and the sky, and I blurted out or said to my friend, in this awe, or this that was, you know, something like, "Why are we here? Or what's the meaning of life? Or what's the meaning of all this that we're here?" And his reply to me was, which I remember very well, was, "Don't be silly." And since he was the older kid, I thought, oh, I was being silly. That was a stupid thing to have asked. And so that part of me just closed right up. Said, okay, forget that. I'm not going to not only not show that anymore, but I'm not even going to let it be there for myself. And so then for a number of years, then that part of me was closed up because of that one little statement that a friend had said. I believe for many people motivation for spiritual practice, spiritual quest, is very tenuous. It's for many people, it's kind of it can be very powerful for them because it can arise out of a very deep place within us. But the depth of it sometimes doesn't correspond with a real strength of purpose behind it. And there can be a lot of other purposes in life which aren't cross purposes with it. There can be the tremendous kind of demands and needs of society and work, and kind of the popular messages of the society often go against that, so that we're embarrassed to show that side of us, or it seems awkward or wrong to show it, or there's no time for it, or we feel like we don't deserve it. And so it easily gets squashed. I believe that, and for different people, the idea of a spiritual longing takes different words or different description. The word longing doesn't work for some people. Some people, it's a quest. I like the word quest a lot because my belief is that human beings are homo questions. That it's built into being human being is to be questing, in the sense that as soon as we know something, as soon as we have some understanding about life, reality, or something, there's always going to be an interest, curiosity, or something propelling us to want to know what's on the other side of that understanding. And we can get some, every generation that comes along kind of goes beyond the boundaries of understanding that the previous generation has had to some degree. You finally figure it out for yourself, and then your children comes along and say, well, what's on the other side of that? Let's go poke and take a look. But I think it's kind of part of who we are, is this kind of questing beyond. What's beyond what we understand? Into, in a sense, into the unknown. What's the unknown? So for some people, the idea of quest works. And unless you're afraid to go on, may take a step beyond what you understand. Some people, it's a longing. Some people, it's a sense of suffering. And some people, they only get onto a spiritual path when their suffering is strong enough. Or the sense of longing or desire or wish for a spiritual practice might be there for years and years. I've known people for whom it was there for 30 years. But they hadn't, you know, they didn't really take it up until they suffered enough. And when they suffered enough, they had no other choice. You know, just, you know, I got to do this. You know, nothing else makes any sense anymore. And so sometimes suffering is what propels a person to take the step into really pursuing some deeper quest or search for peace, for love, for answers to big questions of life, for the possibility of freedom from a heart which is maybe covered, motivated by fear or ambition or many of the things that kind of get in the way of the depths of our luminosity, our clarity, our deep peace. I think the need for spiritual quest, or the need for the individual person to be engaged very powerfully in their own process of liberation, their own process of freedom, their own process of taking responsibility for themselves, is probably stronger in modern society, modern American society, than it has been in most societies ever. In the old days, when most of your community belonged to one religion, or you know, you were very closely tied to a community of faith that you had, there was no questioning of any alternative. It was taken for granted that there was one God and one church and one hierarchy and one book and one thing that provided the answers for you and your particular understanding of life. And you didn't have to do a lot of reflection or thinking or deep analysis or deep kind of inner soul searching to kind of find what the truth is, because it was handed to you. It was obvious. This is what it was. And everyone around you believed this. And it's very hard not to, you know, it's very hard to step outside of how we've been conditioned and trained, if that's the whole view of the whole society or your particular subsection of society. And what's happened in America is that we have a strong legacy of democracy, and we have a strong legacy of diversity. And we have all these different peoples who've come into this society here, and with different religious backgrounds. I mean, it was a big deal 100 years ago or 150 years ago when to have Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics, you know, next to each other in the same neighborhood. I mean, who are they? You know, people didn't encounter each other, let alone Protestant and Catholics. There are all kinds. There's a lot of conflict and tension within Christians in America. And now we have, you know, a wider circle of people who are appearing here and bumping shoulders. And you have so many different options for spirituality, such a tremendous amount of diversity. And how do we negotiate that diversity? How do we decide what is true? I mean, we could fall back on, you know, the particular religion of our family or a particular, you know, whatever reasons, and some particular faith out of faith, out of blind obedience or something. But how do we responsibly go through a situation, religious kind of environment that's democratic and diverse, where we're up to ourselves to somehow vote, up to ourselves to decide. And then we have to decide among this huge collection of different, very different, desperate teachings and practices and possibilities for what life is about. And what it does do, I think, is it, for those who kind of see it this way at least, it really puts the responsibility to sorting through this stuff for the individual. And the individual then becomes very important. You know, how do I, individual means you, how do you find your own way? If you're not going to just listen blindly to a teacher, a book, or a tradition, how do you find your way? You have a spiritual longing or desire for some kind of something, and how do you find your way? How do you take responsibility and take authority for this yourself? Ultimately, in a sense, in a world that's completely diverse, you're accountable to yourself, in a sense, more than you are almost anything else. And this works very well, of course, with the whole legacy of American individualism, which has its dark side. It also has its beautiful side. There's this beautiful story from, I think it's beautiful, nice story, from about the 1830s, around that time, when it seems that the Congress was deciding, trying to decide on a motion, a law, to allow the post office to be closed on Sundays. Because it seems to be in the early years of this country, post office is open 7 days a week. Most people worked, I guess, a lot. And so they wanted to give the post office a day off, Sunday, you know, day of God's rest. And so a Baptist minister, who was also the senator from Tennessee, got up on the Senate floor and gave an impassioned speech saying that this was wrong. The reason it was wrong was that what was sacred, most sacred, was individual conscience. And that you had to allow respect for the individual conscience for people to decide for themselves what faith to pursue. And if you took a Christian notion of what is a sacred day of rest and imposed it on other people of other faiths, on the Jews in America, or whatever, then you're imposing your faith over their own conscience. And this was, you know, a violation of kind of the sacredness of their religious worldview of this Baptist. Does that make sense? So the individual conscience was considered to be so sacred by some of the early religious people of our America, that that they didn't want to violate that by imposing, even, you know, he was a Baptist, you know, his religion on other people by having a holiday on Sunday. So I don't know. Eventually, he lost the vote, I guess. But and you wouldn't expect this from a Southern Baptist today, that kind of point. The Southern Baptists have changed radically in their teachings over the 150 years or so. But there's been a legacy also in the West from Quakers and Baptists, many people, of pointing to that there's kind of a divine spark inside of us, each of us. And so again, the finger points back at us. We have to find that in ourselves. We have to somehow address this in ourselves and not, in a sense, look outside. The Buddha taught, one of the last teachings of the Buddha, was that he said, was be a lamp unto yourself. You know, and he, you know, the Buddha did not want to, in his last days of his life, the Buddha did not want to impose or assign someone else to be the leader, the authority when he died. You know, my disciple Shariputra or Moggallana or whatever, he's the one who's really going to have what it, he's really going to, you know, knows what it's all about, you know, rely on him. He said, be your own light. Have the Dharma, have the teachings in a sense as your guide, but you have to be a light to yourself. So again, that is pointing back to yourself, I think, is a very important aspect of Buddhist practice, and it's also a very important legacy of our American culture. But what do? We turn it back towards ourselves. At the time of the Buddha, there were also a tremendous diversity of spiritual teachings around. And people back then had to sort through them all. And what's interesting is how the Buddha related to the diversity. The Buddha refrained from getting involved in some of the key spiritual questions that people were trying to address and deal with in his era. And these are some of the key things that many of us maybe think are really important for a spiritual life. So, for example, is the world one? Is there a unity? Is all the same? Is it all one? Was a question he didn't want to address. Is it all diverse? Is it all diversity? Are we all separate in some radical way? He didn't want to address that question. What happens to, is the soul and the body the same? Is the soul and the body different? What happens to an enlightened person when an enlightened person dies? Does a person continue? Does a person not continue? Is the world eternal? Is the world finite? There's a lot of kind of questions, these kind of questions which maybe many people will think, these are, you know, this is what I want to know. And the Buddha refused to answer them. And the reason he refused to answer them was, he said, these are not conducive to the spiritual quest, or these are not conducive to your welfare and well-being. These are sidetracks that get you away from this very important way. You need to focus back onto yourself. You need to focus here. So then in the Kalama Sutta, which is also a very famous discourse of the Buddha, he was asked by some people who were not Buddhists, how do we make sense? How do we find our way through all these different spiritual teachings of our times? And the Buddha said, do not rely on what you've heard, on what is traditional, on what's in the books. Do not rely on your own reasoning, your own logic. Do not rely because it's your own preference. You know, what's kind of left? Don't rely on many of the traditional forms you have for taking this as what's authoritative. Don't do it out of respect for the teacher. Rather, the Buddha said, you should use, he said, and kind of paraphrase him, he said, is that you have to become the arbitrator of what is true, or what is worthy of being followed. And the way you do it, you don't have to do that alone. You can use the wise people around you as a help. They can kind of, you can listen to them, and if the wise kind of suggest something, listen more carefully. Kind of, it's kind of like you go to Stanford University or go to university, and there's a lot of different textbooks you could, you know, buy on any one subject, and you have some trust that the professor has chosen the right one that's current and most appropriate. So you listen to wise people to kind of give you some direction of where you might look, but you don't turn the authority over to that wise person. But then more importantly, the Buddha said, you study, you pay attention to what is skillful, what is beneficial, and is conducive to your happiness. And what is it that is harmful and not conducive, which is unskillful for your own benefits and happiness. So you become your own arbitrator by knowing the difference between what are the actions that you do, what are the beliefs that you hold, that create further suffering in you, or help create further happiness. The assumption being that each of us can know the difference between suffering and not suffering. Each of us, it's very hard to know whether the soul is eternal, not eternal, or the universe and self are one or different or something. How do you decide these kinds of questions? Upon what evidence? But do you suffer? And are you not suffering? Is something that you can really feel. And for the Buddha, this capacity we have to see that difference is really a touchstone for finding our way in towards liberation and freedom. How do we become freer of our suffering? We can feel our way into that, which requires mindfulness, that we become present, very present, for our own experience. So we know when we're suffering, know when we're not suffering. And it has been so many times where, you know, myself or other people, where the evidence of suffering occurring, that it's such a powerful clue of what's really going on, a powerful clue that something needs you to stop here and look and reevaluate what you're doing, is overlooked because somehow the suffering propels us to outside of ourselves, you know, to assign blame, to attack. Propels us to run away and be defensive, to get distracted. Suffering is a very, very significant and powerful tool for Buddhist practice, to stop and look at it and let it be a mirror to look more deeply. Because suffering is optional. The sources of suffering, there's an origin, a beginning of suffering inside of us that we can do something about. So there's a lot of spiritual questions that Buddha didn't want to answer at his time. But the one of the very powerful and important currents of debate in spiritual circles at the time of the Buddha was had to do with the nature of causality or will or choice. Does human agency or choice, is there human choice, and does it make a difference? And there were a lot of different theories at the time of Buddha. Yes. Some people said, no, there is no choice. You're kind of stuck, and it's, you know, everything's predetermined, and you can't really do anything about your life and your suffering. You just have to kind of go along with it, and maybe it'll kind of exhaust itself, and then you'll be happy. Or other people said that there wasn't much choice, but there was a little bit if you appease the gods. It's really the gods who, you know, chose your own happiness for you, but you could kind of at least kind of make offerings to them and help them out. The Buddha said there's no spiritual life without choice, without causality. And that kind of points the finger back to us. What are the choices we make? And part of the function of mindfulness is to reveal where the choices are that we make. The choices are very difficult to see. And the people who don't see their choices don't have choices. And we tend to run an automatic pilot. To paraphrase Jung, who said something like, very vaguely, if you don't see where your choice lies, then you're doomed to live a life on fate. Fate takes over, something other. You know, you start acting unconsciously. So we stop for the suffering. So eventually we try to be mindful of it so we can see where the choice is behind it. And sometimes it's as simple as seeing a choice to run away from it, or avoid it, or strike out, or all the kind of dysfunctional ways that we relate to suffering. But to stop to it, really be mindful for it and hang out there, allows us to see where the choice is, so we can choose to go in the direction of being happier, or not suffering as much. We're the only ones who can do that. The assumption, I believe, around this is that who we are in our essence is freedom. In our essence is this, you know, a lamp, a light, a luminosity, a clarity, a peace that's in our core. And that the suffering is the surface of that, that obscures the possibility of deep love or peace or freedom that is, in a sense, could be said maybe our birthright. It's a possibility for all of us. So the mindfulness practice is a practice of really learning to stop and pay attention to what we're doing. And in doing that, finding the place where we can take responsibility for our own life. And of course, it's a lot easier to want to assign the responsibility elsewhere. And many people who are, in many respects, look like adults, are doing that in some ways. And one of the ways that people do it in spiritual circles, in meditation circles, is they think the meditation is going to do it for them. As if somehow there's magic kind of thinking about meditation. If I just put my time in on the cushion, if I just get a little calm or something, or then something will happen and I'll be transformed. I don't know what that is, but if I just kind of do this stuff, then something will happen. Amazing things happen in meditation. Amazing things happen seemingly kind of outside of your choice and your involvement. But Buddhist spirituality, the nexus of it, the locus of it, is the place of choice. Where is it we choose? Where do we take responsibility? For the simple thing is, you're sitting in meditation, and the mind is agitated. Where's your responsibility there? Maybe the responsibility is that when it's agitated, you see that you make all kinds of conclusions based on the agitation. This means that I'm a lousy meditator. This means I can't do it. This means that, you know, that this is wrong. It shouldn't be this way. And that was a choice to have that view, that assumption. It's an assumption. And there's a freedom from certain kind of suffering when we don't have all these reactive ideas about what it means to be agitated. Someone I talked to a week or two ago, it was a big moment of release for her when she, who has a very agitated mind or a very busy mind, realized that she didn't have to fight that. She could just accept that. And the fact was, even though she was very thought-filled in her meditation, there was a kind of mindfulness of that. And she had assumed that there had to be a silent mind in order to be mindful. But when she realized she didn't have to do that, then the suffering that kind of encased the agitated mind was freed from her. So the point of choice there was, am I going to stay kind of locked in these assumptions and reactions and hostility towards my own agitated mind? Or do I release that and just kind of to be mindful of that itself? Very simple, but very freeing. Sometimes agitation is a way of avoiding our responsibility. It's avoiding feeling our suffering. Sometimes agitation is a convenient way of not getting settled to go deeper into what's really going on. We have to somehow be responsible for ourselves. We are the arbitrator. We are the ones who are accountable to ourselves. In a kind of New Age spirituality, it lends itself to the kind of teaching which actually exists in some circles, which is a kind of a misquote of Joseph Campbell. Out of context, the teaching of Joseph Campbell that many people kind of will refer to is that he taught, follow your bliss. And the Buddha said kind of similar. You have to be able to discern the difference between what is conducive to happiness and what is conducive to suffering. And knowing that, go in the direction of freedom from suffering towards happiness. However, that quote by Joseph Campbell is in a section of one of his books that's titled Bliss and Sacrifice. And if you read on further, beyond the chapter, after he says, follow your bliss, he puts it in the context of the necessity of sacrifice and renunciation, which the Buddha also did for his discussion of his path. And sacrifice and renunciation is a big topic in itself, and it's a phenomenally unpopular topic. Follow your bliss is, much more popular. And what's beautiful is Joseph Campbell put both of them together, that both were needed together. So sometimes sacrifice means we actually have to sacrifice some simplistic idea of well-being to be able to go down into the darkness of, of our psyche. Sometimes we need to suffer more in order to suffer less. Sometimes we have to be able to drop the surface agitation and really face the deepest fears and tears, terrors and depressions and that's within us, the darkness, the demons. And that's kind of that sacrifice then, is the sacrifice of a certain level of well-being to go into the deeper stuff, to see through it and go to the other side. To be very honest with what it is, so that we can find again the place of choice, find again the path that's in that, to really find what's really deep inside. There's a beautiful story. It's not exactly a story. I don't know how much of this is true, but maybe it doesn't matter. It's almost like a myth. But I think it's true. And some of it's true. Some of it I knew from the papers back in the 1970s, late 60s. That during World War II, there was, when the Japanese were retreating from the Philippines, they left soldiers behind, or soldiers were left behind in some of the jungles on the islands. And apparently they were told, stay here and fight the war until we come and get you. And no one ever came and got them. And they were kind of in isolated situations, and without radios or anything. And the Japanese, being very dutiful kind of people often, these soldiers stayed fighting the war for decades. And what I remember reading in the paper, I think as late as early 70s, was they'd found this, Japanese soldier still fighting the war in 1972 or whatever. And there was a series of these people found. Maybe that was the last one, early 70s. And What seems to have happened was that when it was discovered there were still Japanese soldiers lost in the jungle, hiding in the jungle, the Japanese would take out of retirement the most senior military officer from World War II and send that person to Vietnam, to Philippines. And the person would go walking through the jungle with his best uniform and his samurai sword and calling out in Japanese, you know, come out, come out. And so the soldier would come out of hiding. And then the first reaction of the general was to thank, you know, way the Japanese can, they're experts at thank yous, and really deep bow and thank you and gratitude towards all the service the soldier had done to the mother country. And just expressing gratitude and thanks. And then they would take the soldier on a boat and to bring the soldier back to Japan and be treated as a hero with lots of gratitude. And just before coming back to Japan, the soldier would be told, and by the way, the war has been over. It's been over for a little while. And we want to thank you so much. You know, you're such a great, wonderful service to the country, and you're such a wonderful thing you've done. What they didn't do was they didn't laugh at him for fighting a war that had been over 25 years. They just constantly showed us gratitude. And then he came back to Japan. He was treated kind of like a little hero. So that, I think that's a very powerful story, whether it's true or not, because many of us are fighting wars which are long over. Wars that we were fighting as children. Wars that sometimes we're not our making. Horrendous things that happen to us as children. And as we try to cope the best we can in impossible, confusing situations. And some people have children have all kinds of coping mechanisms to get them through very, very difficult childhoods. And some of them have, you know, based on fear and running away and being silent. Some of them have to do with, you know, it's all kinds of ways in which children kind of manage to survive in sometimes really impossible situations of abuse and all kinds. And then what happens often enough is that the wars of childhood, the wars of earlier in life, are internalized as being the operating mode which we carry with us long beyond the time of that particular fight, that particular survival times. And many of us then are fighting wars which are long over. And those wars then, because we're still fighting it, it plays itself out in new situations that we find ourselves, you know, 25, 30, 40, 50 years later. And some of the conflict we sometimes have with people have nothing to do with the actual details of the conflict today, but rather the really core power that the conflict for us, the anger or the whatever, has to do with, you know, the continuation of the deep fears or deep anxieties or deep hostilities that you know, sometimes are remnants of these long, long, long over wars that we're fighting. So mindfulness is to stop and sit with all that. A really important aspect of mindfulness is to stop. Is to stop and be still and not run away, not go away, not avoid, but do the opposite of avoiding, but really feel and be present for what's really going on. What's really going on here in a way maybe that you've never been before. And it's difficult to do sometimes because often it is a process which is somewhat unknown. We don't know how to even go through that. If you don't know how to go through that, the tremendous pain that we have, then it doesn't seem like we should go forward into something which is unknown because we don't know how it's going to resolve itself. We can't know how things will resolve themselves, but we need to be able to put the step into that unknown. And sometimes the reluctance to go into our deepest suffering is because we don't know the path through it. There's no map. But we have to kind of be willing to stop and go in and feel it and be for it. And slowly we'll see the places of choice. And a lot of the places we'll see is the places of resistance. We've braced ourselves against life and just let go of that resistance, let go of that resistance, the fear, the clinging, the attachments, so that we can find that lamp, find that luminosity, that freedom, which is the birthright of all of us, which is tender and doesn't seem to offer much, because it doesn't offer us a bank account or a house, or doesn't in itself doesn't offer safety or security or relationships. So we tend to kind of deflect from it very quickly. I think there's a tremendous gravitational force within us towards freedom, towards this deep heart, towards peace, this luminosity, towards non-clinging. The momentum, the gravitational force of other things sometimes carries the day. But once the gravitational force of desires, ambition, fear begins to lessen, then we get caught, we get involved in the gravitational force that brings us, it wants to go, takes us towards increasing freedom. The power of that gravitational force plays itself out in all kinds of ways, unusual ways in our life, mysterious ways in our life. When I lived on the farm in Tennessee in the 70s, which was a very large spiritual commune, where the high priests or priestesses, I guess, of the community were the midwives. And they were considered like the most sacred people there, and literally kind of like the priests, the high priestesses. And so there were a lot of midwife stories, you know, birthing stories that kind of went around. And there were a number of stories that went around, a lot of stories. It was kind of popular to tell these stories of these home births. And there was like not home births, it was tent births. Everybody lived in tents. U.S. Army issued green tents and in the woods of Tennessee. And the stories of these home births, and somehow the baby wasn't coming. And then the midwives would somehow intuit or see it, there was some unresolved tension between the couple, the husband and wife. And they'd say, you know, you guys have to work this out. And so there, you know, with labor pains going, whatever, you know, just, you know, they would work out this intense conflict and, you know, anger and hostility or fear or whatever, you know, the issue was that had to be worked out, had, you know, unresolved. And they would resolve it somehow, you know, they would deal with it in that kind of very charged situation. And then the baby was born. So the story that was told was that sometimes these very powerful need for resolution of certain things is so strong that it put on hold something as powerful as giving birth, because something had to be done, something, real work had to happen. So the last strand of things I wanted to say today, which I don't know, I'm not sure how it fits into all this, but it seems anticlimactic now to say, talk about this, but one of the ways I relate to my son, my 3.5-year-old son, is he loves right now playing with Legos, and he had these little Legos which are very hard to kind of for him to kind of do, and you build these things and they collapse all the time, and it's a great thing for frustration, you know, teaching it to things, you know, it's very, you know, and patience. I think it's a really good skill for him to learn, but he often asks, you know, for me to help, or he gets frustrated, or to this morning we were doing it, and I was playing with him, you know, nicely, you know, back and forth for a while, and then I started building something, but he wanted the piece that I had. And it just somehow it didn't seem right to kind of give him my Lego piece. You have to draw limits somewhere, right? it not for my sake, but somehow for his sake, it didn't seem right to always be giving in to him, you know, that. And I feel like there was a chance for a lesson here somehow. And so I said, there seems to be a problem here. You want this piece, I want this space. What's the solution? Is there a solution? And this is the way I often ask him, there's a problem here, is there a solution? I want to kind of instill in this him in the idea that if there's a problem, there's a solution that we can figure out. And you know, he can help. What is a solution? Can you think of a solution? But in the last week or so, I've changed the wording of it. Rather than saying, there's, you know, can you think of a solution or the solution? What I'm trying to say instead is to him is in the plural, what are some of the possible solutions? I don't want him to get the idea there's only one answer, but rather there's a range of possible solutions to any problem. And I was talking about this with someone on Friday who was very interested in creativity, and she said one of the most common characteristics of creative people is a comfort with ambiguity. And then I remember reading a study where they had given two groups of kids tests. And one group of kids, they said, there's one answer. You're being tested on getting the one right answer, the multiple choice. And the other group of kids, they said, there are several right answers to this question. You have to find the right answers. So they gave these two groups of kids a test. And then they had took a kid somewhere else and said, okay, now you have to choose from these photographs which of these kids would you like to have on your baseball team or basketball team or sports team or whatever. And the kids who had just taken a test where there was one right answer had a very narrow definition of who would be the right people to serve on their team. And the people who had a number of different, understood there could be a number of different right answers, said that there were, had a much wider range of kids they would choose for their sports team, including handicapped kids and all that. So the idea there's a number of different solutions, I think, is very important. The fact that you can find a solution, be comfortable with ambiguity, comfortable with the unknown, so that maybe we can be more brave in going into ourselves and being honest with ourselves and sitting with that which is our, which is us, really discovering ourselves. Sometimes we follow our bliss and sometimes we follow our suffering. And hopefully you know which one is the right one to follow at any given time. But the purpose of it is to find, certainly to find, take responsibility for ourselves, but ultimately is to find the possibility of freedom. And with freedom, our freedom is really a gift that we give to everyone else. If we do our own work, the benefits to the people around us will continue for generations. So those are my thoughts for today, and I'm sorry to have talked so long, and I wish you all a wonderful next few weeks, and if you're interested in seeing the church, you can come up here and look at the pictures. Yes?
So what solution did Tara come up with?
Oh, what did we come up with? I don't think he was particularly motivated to come up with a solution. I think his solution was to kind of, after a while, ignore me. ignore the problem. I think... it was... the solution was for me. I came up with a wonderful solution. After a while, I said, we played for a while, and he kind of ignored me. Then I said, okay, I can give it this piece to you now. It required taking apart everything I'd built. It would take a while, right? So you can take this apart and get your piece now. But while you do that, I need to go and talk to your mom for a while. So that was a wonderful thing for me to kind of keep him occupied for a while so that I could get a few minutes with my wife. I don't know if that was so skillful, but... Anyway, great. Thank you.